Welcome to tonight's program. It is 7 minutes past the hour. That was awful. I never know when the mic is open. 150 years ago, two damn day, the Peach State, that would be Georgia, seceded from the Union. 150. We, the people of the state of Georgia, in convention assembled, do declare and ordain, and it is hereby declared and ordained, that the ordinance adopted by the state of Georgia in convention on the second day of January in the year of our Lord, 1788, whereby the Constitution of the United States of America was assented to, ratified, and adopted, and also all acts and parts of acts of the General Assembly of this state, ratifying and adopting amendments to said Constitution, are hereby repealed, rescinded, and abrogated. Goddamn Yankees! January 19th, 1861. Yee-haw! Oh, my God. So it, no surprise, the Republicans kept their promise today in the House. Their promise of nonsensical acts, pointless charades, and empty hollow measures. That's what they promised, and they delivered. The House repealed the job-killing, the job-killing, kitten-murdering, dog-bruising, baby-abusing, buggering Obama health care bill. It was defeated today. All the Republicans and three Democrats, who will not be in office in 2013, all voted to repeal. It's fitting today. You know, anniversary of that day that we'll live in infamy here in the great state of Georgia, when the rulers back in 1861 said, "We're going to keep our slaves," and bailed out. And today the Republicans bailed out of the health care reform, health insurance reform act. One of the groups that I saw this in the New York Times today, I couldn't believe it. One of the groups that helped fight for repeal of this law and fought against it when it was in the process of becoming law is a small professional group of doctors named the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. They have about 3,000 members. There are 800,000 physicians in the United States. There are 3,000 in this little cluster of morons. Ron Paul of Texas is a member, Paul Brown of Georgia, Tom Price of Georgia, and the new Rand Paul of Kentucky. They're all doctors of one sort or another, and they're all members of the American Physicians and Surgeons. According to the Times, the group has exerted vocal influence in the country's health care debate despite having just 3,000 members. Other medical groups assert that this little organization's physicians are unrepresentative of most of the nation's nearly 1 million physicians. And, this is more important, that its scientific views usually fall outside medicine's mainstream.
I'm not defending mainstream medicine. I'm just saying, you know, there has to be a consensus. I mean, you have to agree that germs cause disease, and it's not haints or evil spirits or the devil. It's germs. You know, you got to have some parameters, right? Let me tell you about this. The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons was founded in 1943. It was opposed to both Medicaid and Medicare. A decade ago, it was among the groups that unsuccessfully urged the United States Supreme Court to release post-mortem. Are you ready for this? They wanted the U.S. Supreme Court to release the post-mortem photographs of Vince Foster, the former Clinton administration official. In its brief to the Supreme Court, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons argued that an independent inquiry was necessary to confirm that Mr. Foster really did commit suicide and wasn't murdered by Hillary Clinton. This will tell you a lot about this group, right? Its internal periodical of this group, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, the internal periodical has published studies arguing that abortion increases breast cancer, which is total nonsense. The National Cancer Institute, I'm not defending them, but I mean, that's like saying, well, if you step on a crack, you break your mother's back. They also link child vaccinations to autism, which has been thoroughly shown to be a plot for this guy in England to make millions of dollars. And if you still believe in that, well, okay, I'm not here to argue it. Another report put out by these freaks is illegal aliens in American medicine, and it contended that illegal immigrants not only brought disease into this country, but benefited if their babies were born with disabilities. How about this? This is what they said. Anchor babies are valuable. A disabled anchor baby is more valuable than a healthy one. These are some miserable sons of bitches. How would you like to have one of these people about to take out your appendix? And at the last minute, just say, now, what side is it on? Eeny, meeny, miny. It's on the left. This organization has also challenged the oversight procedures of state boards that license doctors. You know, when you go into a doctor's office and it says board certified oral surgeon or board certified vascular surgeon or board certified, that means something. But according to this organization, they say that boards like that abuse their power to railroad doctors out of practice. You know, the ones that insist that you're appendix is on the left. Oh, my God. The organization also supports physicians accused of illegally prescribing narcotics. Now, the head of this organization is a physician, Jane Orient, Dr. Jane Orient. And she says that her group favors a free market approach to medicine. You know what that means? You got the jack, you get the treatment. You don't have the treatment. I mean, you don't have the jack, you don't get the treatment. Very simple. Son of a bitch. Free market. And some of the members do not accept payment from government programs like Medicare, Medicaid, or insurance. You know, they just, you pay me the money, or you bring me chickens, or, you know, a quart of strawberries, and I'll do your appendectomy, if I remember what damn side it's on. Now, last thing about this group of morons, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. During the run-up to the health care law, Dr. David McCallop, a Florida neurosurgeon who's a member of the group, he became the subject of controversy when it was reported that he had forwarded, remember that email to Tea Party members that showed President Obama dressed as an African witch doctor with a bone through his nose? You remember that? That was one of these doctors. Jesus Christ. This country is a zoo. It's a zoo. And these clowns, oh, never mind. My God. Remember back in the day when you used to, a doctor would just automatically get your respect? Remember that? And then you have, now you have this group that sends out caricatures of the President of the United States with a bone through his nose. Oh, and let's see. Appendectomy. Left side, right side. Left side, right side. Damn, I can never keep that straight. Incidental music you hear us playing is from the Doobie Brothers. It's a new CD, relatively new, World Gone Crazy. And I strongly recommend you get this. God, I love the Doobie Brothers. I mean, they've had a lot of, you know, a lot of other original members have gone to that, to rock and roll heaven. But this is a great CD. I think it's one of the better ones, best ones they've ever put out. Check it out. World Gone Crazy. And no, they're not sponsoring anything. I just like the music. I got an email from Bob Kincaid at Head On Radio Network. He said, Mike, I don't often actually request coverage of particular items, but this one's rather important. The acting governor of the state of West Virginia has actually issued a, quote, call to arms, end quote, against the EPA and those who support its recent decision to veto a mountaintop removal site. They're rallying on the Capitol grounds in West Virginia tomorrow. At this point, in the wake of Tucson, our best hope is to make sure these thugs know the nation is watching. And he sent me a link at from Huffington Post. This guy is the acting governor. I think he's isn't he a Democrat? I don't know. I know the senator there is. The Senator Manchin is on the same page as this acting governor. But there's a screenshot from the Friends of Coal website promoting acting governor Earl Ray Tomlin's rally for coal tomorrow afternoon at the West Virginia State Capitol. The screenshot says at the top, it says a call to arms, and it started to get some publicity, and the governor's office changed it to alert, alert, alert. Call to arms means one thing. It means pick up your weapon and go kill somebody. That's all it means. Ken Ward Jr., writing at Huffington, said, I spoke briefly with Jacqueline Proctor, spokeswoman for acting Governor Tomlin, and she told me that the call to arms was, quote, an unfortunate use of words, end quote, but that the Friends of Coal site wasn't the governor's to control or comment about. Proctor said she did not know if the government planned to speak to coal industry groups about the use of such rhetoric. Well, of course not. And then from the West Virginia Gazette, this regular readers of Coal Tattoo, I guess that's a blog site, know that one of the things I've tried to do with this blog is encourage folks with various views on the coal industry issues to talk more respectfully with each other and to tone down the political rhetoric, whether it's about a war on coal or comparisons between mountaintop removal and genocide. As the debate continues to heat up, I've had more than one longtime activist comment privately that they're surprised that no one has gotten shot yet. Now, in the wake of the terrible murders in Arizona, there's plenty of talk about the need to calm things down and avoid the harsh tone of political discourse turning into the harsh realities of violence. The right, or that's right, in the middle of an incredibly heated time on the Appalachian coalfields, the then governor, that would be David Manchin, thought that showing himself as using a gun to solve a political issue was a good thing to do. He's talking about now Senator Manchin, who is Joe Manchin, who's a Democrat, I guess. One of his 30-second ads shows him, you know, raising his rifle. It looks like a 30 or something. He raises his rifle and he shoots at a target. And he says he's going to go to Washington. I'm paraphrasing, but he's going to go fight. It's madness. But it was called the Dead Aim campaign, where he shot the rifle and promised to take dead aim at the federal cap and trade bill. And now we have people being gunned down on the streets at political rallies. So the point of all this, there is supposed to be a rally on the Capitol grounds in the state of West Virginia tomorrow. So, you know, if you're going to go there, take your video camera or something in case something happens that is brought about by the right-wing screams for targeting this and shooting that and blowing that away. Bob Kincaid at Head On Radio Network asked me to share that with you. We'll be right back. Too, as you know, I misspoke last night. Tonight was the big state dinner with Chinese Premier President Hu Jintao and Obama and a real glitterati who are also attending. John Boehner and his pet dog, Eric Cantor, decided to pass. It's the third time Boehner has been invited to a state dinner by Obama and refused to go. When Bush was president, he invited Boehner to come for a state dinner for the Queen of England. Of course, Boehner loved it. He went and got his white tie, not black tie, white tie and tails, and showed up. But Boehner, you know, Boehner's a would-be royalist. And, you know, we all know that Hu Jintao is a commie, right? Anyway, Prairie 2 writes, President Hu Jintao is dropping by the White House for a state dinner tonight. This is getting heavy coverage in the Chinese press. Of course, they don't refer to him as president. They call him Chairman Hu Jintao, you know, just like Chairman Mao. When asked about this, the White House said it was a translation issue. Really? It's a translation issue that the public faced of the last big communist oligarchy. It's a translation issue that the last... Wait a minute. Sometimes Perry, too, uses various particles of speech, and they get a little... It's a translation issue that the public face of the last big communist oligarchy should be referred to as president by the U.S. government and the corporate press that is owned by the transnational companies that benefit from sending our jobs over there. Back home in China, they make no pretense that he is president of anything, but simply reflects the will of an eight-man committee that in theory holds all the power. Mr. Hu is set to retire in 2012, and his deputy will assume the job. There is debate in the West as to whether or not these eight men really run things, or if the various bureaucracies like the military, the security state, and the banks are out of control, or at least compete for their own interests in China. This is mostly wishful thinking, as China's resounding success indicates that there is little, if any, real infighting. Referring to a non-democratic leader appointed by a group of eight unelected leaders as president is not a stretch for the establishment in this country. They had no problem in the past referring to non-democratic leaders appointed by as few as five unelected people as president and vice president. It's just a matter of translation. PrairieNumeral2.com. Go to his website and you can find all this and all of his pieces. And then you can have fun like I do trying to sort out the little articles, little parts of speech that occasionally, like little crickets, little grasshoppers, show up in Prairie 2's writing. Not to criticize his writing. It's wonderful. He's our own personal Paul Krugman. Just sometimes it's hard to read, Bruce. I need to lighten up here just for a minute. This is for all the right-wingers who are listening to the program. This is the kind of stuff you like. A top official for the Russian Orthodox Church yesterday proposed creating what they referred to as an all-Russian dress code. And in the process of talking about this, they lashed out at Russian women who leave the house, quote, painted like a clown and, quote, confuse the street with striptease, end quote. Russian women. The Russian Orthodox Church. Do they bugger their little boys and girls, too, like the non-Russian Orthodox? Russian Orthodox is just a branch of Catholicism, right? Oh, don't send me big definitions. You know what I'm saying. Archpriest Veselvolod Chaplin has angered women's groups recently in Russia with his comments about female modesty at a December roundtable on inter-ethnic relations. He said a woman wearing a miniskirt, quote, can provoke not only a man from the Caucasus, but a Russian man as well. Not only a man from the Caucasus. That's the predominantly Muslim region on Russia's southern border, right? What does that mean? He went on to say, if she is drunk on top of that, she will provoke him even more. If she is actively inviting contact and then is surprised that this contact ends with a rape, she is all the more at fault. Woo! So the Russian church, they're going back to what right-wingers in this country. See, a right-winger is a right-winger is a right-winger. If it looks like a right-winger and stinks like a right-winger and thinks like a right-winger, it is a right-winger. It doesn't make a difference if it's in Russia, or Canada, or Paraguay, or the United States, right? A woman wearing a miniskirt can provoke not only a man from the Caucasus, but a Russian man as well. And if she is wearing a miniskirt and provokes a man and gets raped, well, it's her fault. That's what the Christian right in this country says. Christians are the same the world over, aren't they? Huh? Pretty much. Feminists began a series of protests and petitions against Father Chaplin, who leads the church's social outreach department, and is a close associate of Patriarch Kirill the First. I guess that's like the Pope, right? Father Chaplin responded yesterday with a pungent letter saying provocative clothing led to, quote, to short-term marriages, which are immediately followed by rat-like divorces. What's a rat-like divorce? I'm trying to translate directly from the Russian here. Immediately followed by rat-like divorces to the destruction of children's lives, to solitude and madness, to life catastrophe. So, provocative clothing leads to all that. How about that? He argued that clothing was not a private business and that he hoped that Russia would soon be a place where scantily dressed women or men in tracksuits would not be admitted into public venues. How about men in jockstraps? Oh, I'm sorry, that's bootstraps. How about men in jockstraps? Would they be admitted to public venues? He said, you think it's a utopia? Well, you will have to get used to it soon. I don't know what that means. Like I say, I'm trying to... My Russian is kind of rusty. commentators in Russia responded to the idea with shock and large doses of sarcasm. Anton Orekh, a commentator for Echo Moscow Radio, said, it is not good for a woman to wear only one dress. A minimum of three dresses, one on top of one another. This fully corresponds to the dress code of a well-intentioned Russian woman. That's Russian humor. Ludmila Alexeyeva, the chairwoman of the Moscow Helsinki group, a human rights group, called the proposal nonsense. She said the next thing they will say is that women shouldn't wear lipstick. Oh, Jesus Christ. The whole world is going insane. You're aware of that, right? But a right-winger is a right-winger is a right-winger, right? It doesn't make any difference where. This, the Sebulad Chaplin sounds very much like Pat Robertson, doesn't he? Women invite rape and rat-like divorces by wearing a miniskirt. Madness. Every once in a while, I see something in the New York Times that surprises the hell out of me on the business pages. It's written in support, well, not maybe not support of the working class or unions, but sympathetic to the working class or to unions. David Lenhart of the Times usually writes that sort of stuff. And he had something in today that I want to share with you when we come back from this break. Again, like I say, everything is stacked against the worker in this country anyway. That's why every newspaper of any substance has a business section, right? But none of them have a labor section. Isn't that interesting? It wasn't the business community by design that built the middle class. It was the unions, the workers, that built the middle class. Oh, well, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Why, son? watches C-SPAN so you don't have to. It's More Mike Malone.
Ten before the hour. So, David Lenhart, writing New York Times, the headline of his, it's more like a column. It's not a news report. David Lenhart writes opinion pieces. In wreckage of lost jobs, lost power. He writes that alone among the world's economic powers, the United States is suffering through a deep job slump that can't be explained by the rest of the economy's performance. The gross domestic product here, total value of goods and services, has recovered from the recession better than in Britain, Germany, Japan, or Russia, yet a greatly shrunken group of American workers working harder and more efficiently is producing these goods and services. And he goes on to say that economists are now engaged in a debate about the causes of the American job slump. The American jobless rate is higher than China's. It's higher than in Britain or Russia, higher than in Germany or Japan. And the ones with worse unemployment than the United States are those still mired in crisis like Greece, Ireland, and Spain. And Lenhart points out the financial crisis, yes, originated here and was so severe, and that plays some role in the fact we're having this jobless recovery. The United States had a bigger housing bubble than most other countries, which leaves a large group of idle construction workers who can't easily switch industries. And businesses are not hiring workers out of fear or greed that heavily indebted households won't spend much in coming years. But beyond these causes, the basic structure of the American economy also seems to be an important factor, Lenhart points out. This jobless recovery is the third straight recovery since 1991 to begin with months and months of little job growths. Why? The obvious reason is the balance of power between employers and employees. Aha. Relative to the situation in most other countries, David writes, or in this country, for most of the last century, American employers operate with few restraints. Unions have withered, at least in the private sector, and courts have grown friendlier to business. Many companies can now come much closer to setting the terms of their relationship with employers, with employees, letting them go when they become a drag on profits and relying on remaining workers or temporary ones when business picks up. It's a predatory capitalist dream here in the United States. Consider the main measure of corporate health, profits. In Canada, Japan, and most of Europe, corporate profits have still not recovered to pre-crisis levels. In the United States, profits have more than recovered, rising 12%. Since late 2007. For corporate America, the Great Recession is over. For the American workforce, it is not. And he goes on, in you can read it. Go online, New York Times, nytimes.com. It's in the business section. He says, today, unions are clearly playing on an uneven field. Companies pay minimal penalties for illegally trying to bar unions, and have become expert at doing so, legally and otherwise. For all their shortcomings, which he doesn't include here, he says unions may remain many workers' best hope for some bargaining power. Well, yeah. The destruction of the labor movement in this country started by Ronald Reagan, started seriously by Ronald Reagan in modern times, was the first step necessary in bringing about the change of the United States from a representative democracy to an oligarchy, a corporate state, a fascist state, whatever you want to call it, it's all the same. So it's good to see someone like David Lenhart of the Times at least acknowledge the fact that the reason the American worker is in such bad shape relative to this country, but also relative to workers around the globe, is because unionized labor just doesn't exist anymore in the private sector. And now the Republicans are trying to bust up public sector unions school teachers, sanitation workers, cops, firefighters, social services workers, postal workers, although the post office is not a completely a public corporation. But the whole goal here is to destroy any chance of cohesiveness for the American workforce, to make it impossible to organize, to make it impossible to be a resisting force against this kind of gangster capitalism. And the bastards are succeeding. Not everywhere. There are a lot of companies that still have a unionized workforce. They're very profitable. Of course, what the capitalist pigs don't understand, I mean, even Henry Ford, as much as a German or Nazi sympathizer as he was, he understood that if he didn't pay his workers enough to buy the products they were manufacturing, he could go bankrupt or he could become unemployed himself. He could lose his whole company. So he decided to pay workers, what was it, $5 a day, unheard of at the time, so that the workers who worked for Henry Ford could afford to buy the products that were being produced by the workers who worked for Henry Ford, who were had to buy the product. Well, you know what I mean. All right, is it time for a break? Let me out of here. We got to take a break. We'll come back momentarily and probably take some phone calls. You want to do that? 877-996-2556 is the number if you want to check in. We'll be right back. Before we go to your calls here, Jim Hightower, who's one of the giants from Texas, along with Molly Ivins and a couple other people, but Hightower, who still writes, has a little column out. He writes, earlier this month, when John Boehner was sworn in as the new Speaker of the House, he tipped his hat to the teabag activists across the country who had fueled the Republican takeover of the chamber last fall. He almost choked up as he promised to give government back to the American people. Boehner was not choking back tears, however. He literally was choking on the flagrant hypocrisy of his words, kind of like Limbaugh choking on his own throat fat, right? You see, the people he's giving the government back to are not Tea Partiers, but the rapacious corporate lobbyists who ran the Congress during the years when Tom DeLay ran the show. Remember him? Apparently, the name Boehner is derived from an ancient Teutonic word meaning business as usual. Well, there's another meaning for it. Also, Jim. Throughout his two decades in Congress, the new speaker has been a reliable ally of corporate interests in recent years. He has formed unusually tight legislative, political, and even social ties with groups of lobbyists for such giants as Citigroup, Coors, Goldman Sachs, Google, R.G. Reynolds, Coors, and Coors, and Coors, and R.G. Reynolds, and Coors. Oh, let me digress. Do you see him on television today? His orange tan was all fiery red. He spent too long in the coffin, in the what is that? Tanning bed. Yeah, you see, he was all pinkish, kind of a pinkish. He's going to make an interest. I had a friend. Come on, Mike, get it together. I had a friend who in high school whose father was a mortician. Back when we used the term mortician. I don't know what they call him now. Larry, my friend, said that his dad always appreciated the people who died from carbon monoxide poisoning because they were real red, their flesh. They didn't have to paint them all up. You know, they didn't have that cadaverous dead person look. They looked healthy, even though they were dead. And I'm just wondering if a mortician ever got his hand, you know, if Boner were to keel over from all those cigarettes or booze or whatever, if a mortician would say, well, thank God he used to get in the tanning bed. I digress. Jim Hightower says, of course, most congressional leaders work with lobbyists, so that's not odd. But to have them also be his closest friends and social chums, well, you just want to say, for heaven's sake, Johnny, get a life. These influence peddlers are now the speaker's inner circle, guiding his legislative decisions. Even before last November's election, Boner had a private meeting with a flock of top corporate lobbyists to help shape a new GOP agenda. Forget the Tea Party. No Tea Party operative is a Boner insider. It's the corporate agenda that Republican leaders will be pushing. And to make sure that it stays on track, Boner has hired top corporate lobbyists to be his policy director. So, while Tea Party regulars are giddy with the thought that their movement took over the U.S. House, they were actually a Trojan horse. They delivered the votes to make Boner Speaker, which allowed the corporate powers to move inside, quietly take over, and return Congress to business as usual. You stupid Tea Partiers. You're like the religious right. Every year you would vote for the congressional candidates who would say, well, we're going to stop abortion. We're going to make sure the queers can't get married. We're going to make sure there's a gun in every household. We're going to... On opening day of the 112th Congress, beaming members of the new Republican majority entered the House chamber, accompanied by their proud families. But the moment did not belong to members alone. Also entering the Capitol for the swearing-in ceremonies was David Koch, the multi-billionaire industrialist and laissez-faire extremist who bankrolled much of the Tea Party GOP victory last fall. What symbolism! The members were taking office, but Koch and his corporate agenda were taking power. Indeed, Hightower writes many lobbyists for Wall Street banks and big corporations have been hired as top legislative aides for Republican members. As Joe Representative John Campbell put it, you want someone with experience. Yeah, experience in corporatizing our government. In fact, some of the most powerful lawmakers in the House are simply handing their power over to corporate interests. For example, Representative Spencer Baucus of Alabama, the new chairman of the Wall Street Oversight Committee, declared that his role is to, quote, serve the banks. End quote. Jesus, God. Yeah, okay. And the chief comforter of corporate crybabies, however, is Representative Daryl Issa of California, chair of the wide-ranging government reform committee. He sent the letters we talked about last night to 150 corporate interests, asking them to tell him what to do. The letter unleashed an outpouring of corporate whining. Big banks, for example, wailed that their ability to gouge customers with rip-off debit card fees had been curtailed. There, Issa said soothingly. I'm here now. I'll make it all better for you. Under the guise of giving government back to the people, the House majority is giving it to the corporate powers who finance their campaigns. This is not just business as usual. It's business way more than usual. Oh, my goodness sakes alive. Well, you dumb bastards that voted Republican, let's see what happens, right? You had 8 years of it. Did you like it? Did you like it under Bush? You must have. There must have been something that happened under Bush and Cheney that just was like sex or something for you, right? Whatever. Mark is in San Francisco, listening to Green 960. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm in the middle of this war on the middle class after 30 years and trying to survive like everybody else. And
are you winning?
Wars going on in Afghanistan and Iraq that are just blowing money and killing people, and it's just such a waste. And, you know, the middle class and the people in this country are just getting killed financially.
How long do you think there's going to continue to be a middle class?
Mike, it really looks bad. I'll tell you when it's really going to take a dive is if they get their hands on Social Security and destroy that.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're really going to see the destruction of the middle class. That's what's keeping us above water, I think, right now.
Well, you know, Mr. Obama said that, or he inferred that changing Social Security is not off the table. You know, the centerpiece of liberalism in this country for the past 80 years has been Social Security. The one system that has worked wonderfully, marvelously. It's never had to be funded by the government. It's never gotten into a bankrupt situation. It's moved right along. And the Republicans, of course, if they see something that works, they want to destroy it.
Yes, they do, Mike. And the problem is that Social Security also has a big effect on unemployment. If we didn't have Social Security, there'd be so many more people in the workforce. You know, I mean, it just goes on and on and on, the devastation of even putting this on the table. You would think that a Democratic president would do everything he could to either strengthen it or protect it.
You'd think.
But, yeah, you would think. And this is where this president fails. This president fails on basically the economics and the economic, you know, health of this country. He's failed. And, you know, I hate to say it. I was hoping he would do well in that area, but he's failed. And if he puts Social Security on the table, what I'm going to do, Mike, is call my congressmen and senators and tell them, if anything happens to Social Security, it's going to affect the way I vote. I mean, that's all we can do, because I'll tell you, Mike, this Social Security issue, it hits home hard with me, because guys like you and me have been putting in it all our lives, and these thieves want to take it, because that's all the Republican Party is. And some of these Democrats are thieves.
That is so true. Mark, thanks. I appreciate
your
comments. All right, take care. Yeah. Thieves, liars, knaves, cheats, highwaymen, corporate whores. No offense to real sex workers. We'll be right back. Equipment. Just play some Doobie Brothers and forget about it. All right. 21 past the hour. One more thing here. As soon as the singing stops. Thank you. Is it the end of days? You know, all the birds falling out of the sky and the fish going belly up and the porpoises dying on the East Coast and you know, all this stuff going on. Guess what? In Wisconsin, the discovery of approximately 200 dead cows on a dairy farm in Wisconsin has caused some jittery theologians, what about the farmers, to proclaim that the end of the world may be at hand. Dead cows. There you go. That's the breaking of the seventh seal, I guess. While tests are being conducted before an official cause of death is pronounced, the farmer who discovered the cows has a less dramatic explanation of what killed his livestock. Infectious bovine rhinotracheitis. Now, this comes from Surge Desk blog site. They found a few facts about the disease that, unlike biblical prophecy, has been positively identified in a number of other mass bovine deaths. It is highly contagious. The symptoms aren't pretty. Do you want to hear what the symptoms are? Of cows infected with infectious bovine rhinotracheitis. You don't want to hear the symptoms? Okay. Okay. And there's no treatment. There's no surefire treatment. Um, 200 dead cows. Can you imagine waking up, you're a cow farmer? I mean, a dairy farmer or beef, herd, cattle, whatever. And you wake up in the morning and you go out to do your cows. I mean, if they're dairy cows, you milk them. If they're cattle, you go out and feed them or whatever. And you see 200 dead cows in your pasture or in your... Can you imagine? I mean, how, what do you do?
Get out the barbecue grill.
Get out the barbecue grill? No. Oh, my God. TJ is in Olympia, Washington. Hello, TJ.
I'm doing good, Mike. How are you?
I'm fine.
Yeah. You know, I was just calling to let you know, just to support you, because, you know, sometimes you're out there, and I feel that sometimes myself, that, you know, I'm just out here, you know, carrying the banner myself, and then I run into people, and they go, Mike Malloy? Yeah, we listen to him, too.
Oh, yeah?
It's, you know, you always talk about your 25-cent radio station. Well, it's a lot more than that, brother.
Well,
a lot
no,
more
that, than that. No, really, it is. It's a 25-cent program because that's what it costs if you want, if somebody wants to buy the a subscription to the podcast downloads. It costs $59.60 a year, which works out to about 25 cents a program. So that's why we just call it a 2-bit radio program.
Yeah, well, that's cool. I just wanted to let you know that, you know, you've got a silent majority out here that supports you. And
well, that's very kind. That's very kind, too. Yeah, that's kind. Thanks, TJ. I appreciate the nice words, okay?
You bet.
All right, sir. Take care. He's listening on KPTK. KPTK. Jeremy is in Burlington, Vermont, listening on Sirius. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good. I'm just calling with another example of how guns kill people.
Hey, listen, can you take me off the speakerphone?
Yep. Hold on a second.
Okay. Boom, 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 boom.
Is that any better?
Yeah, much better.
Okay. I was calling with an example of how guns kill people, regardless of what other people say.
Right.
Yesterday, on Martin Luther King, Tuesday, Monday, uh-huh. We had a kid two towns over from here who brought a handgun to school.
Yeah.
And shot himself in the bathroom. Now, that's shocking enough, but the second shocking part is the school day continued as normal.
I didn't hear about this. Where am I, Mike? What, do you know what town?
This is Jericho, Vermont.
In Vermont?
In Vermont, yeah.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I was looking at my screen wrong. You're in Burlington. So it was in Vermont. No, I didn't hear a word about it. Kid accidentally shot himself or?
No, he committed suicide.
Oh, Jesus, God.
With a handgun, nonetheless.
Yeah.
And like I said, the school day continued as normal. They gave an excuse that they were going to like, shelter the kids in case we needed some sort of help, but it just seemed kind of weird to me.
It's just becoming so common, isn't it?
Exactly. It's just commonplace nowadays.
And the kids that are absorbing all this trash talk from right-wingers and from the gun nuts. And, you know, I just wish somebody would have a chance to tell a kid that was flirting with the idea of self-destruction that, you know, just don't do it, that things get better, things change. you know, on and on. That's awful stuff. Hey, thanks, Jeremy. I appreciate you checking in, okay? Take care. We'll be right back.
Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Mike is in Atlanta. Hello, Mike.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
I'm glad to get to talk to you. I listen to you almost every night. I don't agree with a whole lot you got to say, though.
Well, that's all right. What don't you?
But I heard you talk about
spirit. What don't you? Just off the top of your head, what don't you agree with? Just curious.
The thing that got me going tonight was Social Security.
What about it?
I mean, well, you were just talking to the other guy, and they were talking about what a great program it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I mean, I put in roughly $5,000 a year in Social Security. If I die the day before I retire, that money's gone. Why has the government got to say that it's, that they decide what to do with my money? That money, if it was even buried in my yard.
What if you don't die?
What if I didn't die and I had it all myself in the way I wanted to?
So you're one of these people that you're just in it for yourself. The rest of the world can piss off. Your fellow Americans, it doesn't matter. Do you know what Social Security is used for? Do you think it's just an insurance policy for workers? What, do you have any idea what Social Security does? Let me ask you something. Suppose then, Mike, there were some people that lived down the street from you. Let's say a 45-year-old woman whose husband died, and she had three children under the age of 18, and they were collecting that Social Security from the father who died. Now, he didn't get the money, but the kids got it, and the wife gets it. Would you take it away from the kids?
No.
What is it you want to do? You just want to drop out but leave the kids in it. Let me ask you something else. About another block down the street, there's a man who was worked his ass off all his life. He worked in heavy duty construction. He would run front loaders. He would run great big ass machines that would move stuff. And one day, no fault of his own, but one day, a front loader just reared up on him and tipped over, and it broke his spine. So he was paralyzed for the rest of his life, and he now gets Social Security payments, disability payments. Would you take that away from him?
No, I understand that.
Okay, well then, what do you say? You told Kathy you think Social Security is an entitlement. No, it's not. The money that goes to the defense industry is an entitlement. They don't do anything to earn the billions that go to the war industry. It's not even the defense industry. It's the war industry. But all right, let me ask you one more thing. A couple blocks away from your house, there's another guy. He's 36 years old. Through no fault of his own, he is mentally disabled. Let's say maybe it was a genetic thing. Disabled according to the normal standards. I mean, he's not as sharp as you are and not as quick as I am. But he gets Social Security supplement income because he didn't really do anything except he was born with this disability. And there's no way he can work. There's no way he can do anything. And his Social Security disability payment pays his rent, buys his groceries and keeps him on his meds. Would you take that away from him?
No, I understand that.
But okay, well, then, Mike, we're in agreement. Social Security is not an entitlement. It's not okay. Nobody's entitled to it. We all of us pay into it. Hell, you know, I've got a kid 6 years old. So if I die tomorrow, I'm not, you know, I won't get all that money that I paid in, but my daughter will until she's 18. Do you have children?
Yes, I have four.
Okay. What happened? You said if you die tomorrow, all the money you paid in, $5,000 a year, whatever, do you know where that's going to go? If you do drop dead tomorrow and you don't collect it, you know where it's going to go?
The ones that are younger than 18.
And to your wife, to your kids, would you take that away from them?
That's not what I understand that. But let me ask you.
Well, Mike, all we've done here is talk about what Social Security really is. I mean, that's what we're talking about. I just gave you four or five examples of what it really is. Now, what do you think it is?
The part that I don't like is Social Security gets paid to everybody. I understand that. But I think that I should be able to control my own money. Everybody
Nobody's stopping you from controlling your own money. You can control your own money as much as you want. Do you not like paying, what is it now? It just got reduced down to, 4.2% of earned income goes into the Social Security fund for your wife, your children, that mentally retired man down the street, the guy with a broken back, the unemployed person who can't work because of a disability, the old lady who's not quite old enough to draw Social Security yet, but she's getting it from her husband because he's dead. I mean, come on, Mike. We're in this together. Don't you understand that? You don't live on an island, pal. You live in the United States of America. Aren't we supposed to? I mean, is the idea of all of us helping each other, is that become so useless?
No. Help.
Okay. All right.
Help.
Well,
you have people who come across that are here illegal. And then they go and get our services.
Oh, Mike, let's not talk about illegals. Come on. I mean, my God, don't fall back on that Fox terrorist network crap. We're talking about Social Security. That's what we're talking about. And those illegals that come here, if they are paid properly, they contribute to Social Security too. And you know the joke, Mike? They'll never be around to collect it because they're going to be deported. So if they're not contributing to Social Security, you know why? Because their employer, usually a white American, is a goddamn thief. And he's stealing from them. He's stealing from the American people, Mike. He's stealing from your children. He's stealing from my children. He's stealing from the old ladies and the old men and the unemployed and the physically handicapped and the mentally handicapped. And you're going to tell me that all of that is because that undocumented worker. Mike, listen, I appreciate you checking in. But, you know, when you really get down to it, you and I don't have any disagreement about Social Security whatsoever. And for heaven's sake, when your point of view, and I understand you were trying to make a point of view, and I respect that, and we deep-sixed that point of view. So don't just immediately fall back and start screaming illegals. Come on, that's Sean Hannity. That's Glenn Beck. That's Rand Paul or somebody. For God's sake, pal, come on. But I'm glad you called, Mike. I really am, because I think, you know, you answered your own questions. I didn't answer it for you. You answered it. Social Security is not an entitlement. It's an insurance plan. It's not even a retirement plan. It's an insurance plan. And not a very good one when you get right down to it. But it was designed because we live in a capitalist society, and the capitalists, Mike, don't care if you live or die. As a matter of fact, they wish you would die. That was the example you used. What happens if you pay in all this money and then you croak and you don't collect? Well, your kids will, you know, just like my kids will. But, I mean, the only kind of little insurance we've got, sure, we should all have retirement plans. We should all buy annuities when we're young and we're working. We should all have 401ks, but then, of course, The capitalist pigs on Wall Street walk in and destroy the 401k. Anything you try to retire, you put in a bank, you buy real estate, look what they did to it. Crash! I understand your concern, Mike, but I think it's a little bit misguided. You know what I'm saying? And I appreciate the fact that you were able to see that you wouldn't want to take away that money from, you know, from kids, yours or somebody else's. You wouldn't want to take away that money from a widow or somebody somebody who can't work because of physical or mental handicap. Or, you know, I appreciate that. You're not a hardcore right winger at all. And I think you understand. I think you do understand way down deep. But I think a lot of people have been probably been talking around you. I mean, you know, most of us are exposed to right-wing talk radio, and we hear this crap 24/7, coast to coast, border to border. Mike, it's all lies. It's nonsense. We're all in this together. You know, Ben Franklin said, wasn't it Ben Franklin? We'll hang together, or we'll all hang separately. You know what I mean? We have a break here. All right, before we take another call, we have to take this break. Do 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 do. It's a long 20 seconds waiting for that old clock to move around. All right, Nora in Minneapolis, we're going to come to you, and Paul in Canton, Georgia, and whoever's on the third line trying to get through, we'll get to you in un momento, por favor, just as soon as we pay some of the bills. Are you all listening? If you're listening online or listening in the chat room, I hope you're liking the Doobie Brothers, this new CD that they have out, that we're playing the hell out of it tonight. World Gone Crazy. It's a great CD. We'll be right back.
Tell the truth and stand your ground. Don't let the bastards get you down.
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 Don't let the bastards.
Welcome back. It's 10 before the hour. Nora is in Minneapolis. Hey, Nora.
Hey, Mike. Oh, that guy made me laugh my ass off. I think I lost weight.
Really?
Oh, God. Well, because my view of Social Security, I know almost everything about it, and I was going to talk about that. But two other things that I wanted to get in before that.
Yeah?
One is just a website. Because Colleen Rowley wrote the greatest opinion article from top to bottom of the page of Sunday's Star Tribune, and so the website for that is startribune.com/opinion. It's about we're conflating proper dissent and terrorism. And it's like a college class. She goes on telling three different things that the federal government needs to fix so they're not doing unconstitutional activities.
Uh-huh. All
right. It's the case of the FBI problem, right?
Yeah.
And I have a question for you.
Sure, go ahead.
About... Okay, we on local KTNF 950 AM, we have this radio show on Sunday called Religious Radio Not Quite Right.
Yeah.
And it's extremely liberal Christian guy.
Yeah.
And he came up with his theory this Sunday, and I was wondering what you think about this. He says that when the Bible says that it's against homosexual, that was a total misinterpretation to our culture now. From what they meant that they were talking about was when males would get with young slave boys and do something with young slave boys, they were against that. The Bible was against it, and they translated it wrong and called that homosexual.
Well,
and it wasn't.
Nora, what I was going to say is that, you know, some of the, you know, this whole gay thing, the whole Bible thing is just nonsense and hog snot. I mean, Solomon and David, you know, two of the superstars in all three peoples of the book, I don't want to say bisexual. They were, whatever their sexuality was, it included men and women and possibly sometimes long-eared goats. You know, didn't make any difference. Sex is sex is sex. But, you know, you gotta stop and think if the Christians are right and there was only Adam and Eve and then they had Cain and Abel, and then Cain murdered Abel and then Cain was banished from the garden, and sent to the land of Nod, which is east of Eden, and there he knew his wife. What the hell are they talking? Come on. Nora, the Bible to me is like any collection of religious mythologies and superstitions. It certainly has a lot of interest and a lot of value to cultural anthropologists maybe, or to people like me who see it all as weird and wicked. And, you know, the Bible is all about mass murder and genocide and incest. I mean, the whole Christian faith, if you go back to Lot and his wife, and, you know, she got turned into a pillar of salt, and then, you know, Lot and his two daughters had sex, and after filling the old man full of wine, and, I mean, come on! And from Lot comes, eventually down the line, comes David. It wasn't Jesus of the house of David? Oh, my God! Jesus was a product of incest? You see how crazy it can be. I mean, it's craziness. I mean, you've got a history of a bunch of people who wandered around the desert 6,000 years ago and had visions and hallucination. Ever spent any time in the desert? I've never spent any time in the desert, the Negev or the Sinai or any of those places, but I've spent time in the desert in the United States. And I'll tell you what, after about a day or two, you start to say things, brother. You see things that move and fly when there's really nothing there. I don't know. It's just, come on, Nora. You shouldn't ask me questions about the Christian, the Jewish, or the Muslim mythologies. I mean, they're very interesting. I found them all just extremely, and I don't mean this in a bitchy way, but extremely entertaining. You know, when you stop and think that, you know, poor old Moses wandered out there for 40 years and stuff was dropping from the sky to feed him and all that. And he went up on the mountain and got the tablets and busted his ass for this crazy God who was writing stuff. And, you know, and then when the payoff came, you know, Moses out there for 40 years. When the payoff comes, what did God say? Sorry, Moses, you're not going. You're not going. I'll let your son go, but you're not going. Why? Oh, I don't know. I've got a headache today, I guess, and I'm just going to let you go. And then he says to Joshua, oh, by the way, when you cross over, there's some people already there called Canaanites. Butcher them. Butcher them all. Butcher the men, the women. When you find women with pregnant bellies, rip their guts open and tear the babies out. Oh, but now wait a minute. We're anti-abortion. We're anti-gay. We're anti-this, we're anti-that, we're anti-this, we're anti-that. Yeah, da-da-da-da-da. Anti, anti, anti. Poor Moses. But God, I put up with this out here for 40 years. You know, with Baal and all these crazy people making the golden calf. I bust my ass for you and you're not even going to let me go to the promised land? Nope. Why not? I've got a headache. All right, that's all for me. I can't take any more tonight. Come on, how many seconds we have left? Where's there? 4, 3, 2. All right, listen, thanks for hanging out tonight. And all you little right-wing toads, you little cockroaches that are sending me these emails about, oh, Sean Hannity, oh, Russia's neck fat. bite me. I'll see you tomorrow night, y'all. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. I want to get into this this thing about how much effect Lockheed Martin, the weapons manufacturer, has in your life, or even control over your life. Huh? No? Think I'm kidding? I'll get to it in a second. But first, getting back to that theme of equivalence. Radio talkers on the left, what are there, five of us, are somehow equally culpable for the violence and insanity and destruction of the political system in this country as the hundreds of neo-fascists on the right. That's the prevailing argument right now, put out there by not only people on the right, but a few notables on the liberal side of the aisle. That it's the responsibility of people like me to dial back the rhetoric. And I've said before that as long as I see people literally destroying the country, and the proof is in the proof, it's not theory. Take a look at the country. Take a look at the middle class. Take a look at U.S. foreign policy. Take a look at our financial situation. Take a look at our indebtedness. Take a look at the maniacs who now run the Republican Party and the cowards who infest the Democratic Party. The proof, as Grandma used to say, is in the pudding. It's right there. These insane people on the right, though, with all their booger bears and their monsters and their things lurking in the basement, and the communist who's now in the White House, and the radical Marxist-leaning Democrats and progressives who want to, well, you know. Well, here, once again, let's listen to that great American leader, Glenn Beck.
The radicals that you in Washington have co-opted and brought in wearing sheep's clothing, change the pose, you get the ends. You've been using them? They believe in communism. They believe and have called for revolution. You're going to have to shoot them in the head. But warning, they may shoot you. They're dangerous because they believe. Karl Marx is their George Washington. You will never change their mind. They want to overthrow our entire system of government, and their words say it. Why won't you believe it? The revolution of 1776 was a picnic compared to what the revolutionaries of today would like to do. It's not a lot of fun. Usually millions of people die. But I'm glad to see our politicians will co-opt those people so they can have power. Fundamental transformation. It's what America is going through right now. And the progressives, the Marxist revolutionary progressives, are still not happy.
Wow. shoot them in the head. But of course, they're going to shoot you first. This is Glenn Beck. This is the Rupert Murdoch terrorist broadcast network that pumps this garbage out day in, day out, across the fruited plain, 24/7. The Rupert Murdoch terrorist broadcast network and the Rush Limbaugh Excellence in Broadcasting Network. Every minute of every day, somewhere in this country, you can hear that. Shoot them in the head, Beck says. Where was the representative shot? Ah, in the head. Oh, no, 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 no. Anybody who claims that the right-wing crazy people in radio and television have anything to do with this is obviously just trying to stir up trouble against these good, God-fearing, Christian, white, America-loving patriots. It's incredible. Let's listen to it. One more time.
The radicals that you in Washington have co-opted and brought in wearing sheep's clothing, change the pose. You get the ends. You've been using them? They believe in communism. Ah. They believe and have called for revolution.
Ah.
You're going to have to shoot them in the head. But warning, they may shoot you.
You're going to have to shoot them in the head. You're going to have to shoot them in the head. Gee, that must be code for you're going to have to shoot them in the head. Yeah. That's the great Glenn Beck.
One of the things I found most disturbing about following the Arizona shootings, the message boards on Glenn Beck's website, and I think Sarah Palin's and maybe some others, the violent rhetoric that people were saying, their followers were saying, you know, like, it was, the only tragedy here is that Gabriella Giffords didn't die.
Oh, yeah.
Or that the little girl, the little 9-year-old Christine Green, you know, well,
she could have grown up to be Hitler.
What if you had the chance to go back and kill Hitler? Wouldn't you have done it? Because surely she was going to be another Hitler. Now, that can only be inspired by
some crazy man. This is what I have a feeling that Keith Olbermann was trying to say is somehow the responsibility of my little 25-cent radio program when he included me in a list of people the other day that included Glenn Beck. Shoot them in the head. You're going to have to shoot them in the head, Beck says. Shoot them in the head. Wow. But, again, anyone who suggests that, whether it's John Stewart or Keith Olbermann or anyone on the liberal side of the equation, so-called, who suggests that the few remaining progressive or liberal talkers have a responsibility to, to dial back what we don't say? Shoot them in the head? Only watch out because they're going to shoot you? I don't think that anyone on the so-called liberal left, the few little voices that remain, says things like that. I can't speak for anyone else on the so-called liberal left. Pour moi, I get very, very, very angry. And I will express that anger. And I will say things like Rush Limbaugh someday is going to choke to death on his own throat fat. But is that the same as suggesting you're going to have to shoot them in the head? I don't quite see that.
Well, I think especially since what Glenn Beck is advocating is going and shooting just your average people in the head, not media personalities, and you're certainly not suggesting anybody shoot Rush in the head, but what he is saying is,
this is insanity.
Tea Party patriots, get ready to go shoot other people, citizens,
right,
in the head.
Because they're
Marxists.
Communists, Marxist radicals who have come to Washington to overthrow the government. You lying piece of human waste, Beck. You really are.
Music played and people sang. Just for me, the church bells rang. I don't know why, and till this day sometimes I cry. He didn't even say goodbye, he didn't take the time to lie. Bang, bang, he shot me down. Bang, bang, I hit the ground. Bang, bang, that awful sound. Bang, bang.
It's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Eisenhower's famous warning on the eve of his departure from the political stage about the military-industrial complex was prescient, but it didn't go far enough. Not at all. We live in the initial stages, well, the secondary stages of a national security state that is based on the idea of permanent war, and that national security state has so infiltrated just, I mean, every aspect of your life, my life. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that after this this next break. It's just astonishing. You're going to find this hard to believe. I certainly did. But in the meantime, Alabama Governor Robert Bentley, the new governor of Alabama, I think it was yesterday. Was it yesterday? Told a church crowd just moments into his new administration that those who have not accepted Jesus Christ as their own personal savior are not his brothers and sisters. Governor of Alabama. And I like the way Associated Press puts this. That shocked some critics who questioned yesterday whether he can be fair to non-Christians. I guess on Monday, his inauguration day, according to the Birmingham News newspaper, he said at a church service, he was at the Dexter Avenue King Memorial Church. Yeah, that one. He said, anybody here today who has not accepted Jesus Christ as their Savior, I'm telling you, you're not my brother and you're not my sister. The governor of Alabama. Oh, well, why is that? That's not shocking. Why are you acting shocked, Mike? Bill Nigut, the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, said yesterday that Bentley's remarks were shocking. Nigut said, quote, his comments are not only offensive, but also raise serious questions as to whether non-Christians can expect to receive equal treatment during his tenure as governor, end quote. Da-da, 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 da-da. He was at the Dexter Avenue King Memorial Church after the official inaugural ceremony, and the new governor of the great state of Alabama told the crowd that he considered anyone who believed in Jesus to be his brothers and sisters, regardless of color. Oh, Lord have mercy, he's going to include the color folks. Why, that is so gracious of you, Massa. It sure enough is. But anyone who isn't a Christian doesn't have that relationship with His Honor, the governor. After his speech, Governor Bentley said he did not mean to insult anyone. And his office, what does that mean? His office released a statement. Some flack who works for this racist son of a bitch issued a statement yesterday saying the governor believes he is the governor of all of Alabama. You know, that'd be the Jews and the Muslims and if there's any Wiccans out there or Native American practitioners, or how about them are atheists? Oh, well, okay, not them. The statement went on to say, unsigned statement, the governor clearly stated that he will be the governor of all Alabamians. Did you get that when he says, anybody here today who has not accepted Jesus as their Savior, I'm telling you, you're not my brother and you're not my sister. Oh, no. You misheard. The governor clearly stated that he would be the governor of all Alabamians, Democrat, Republican, and Independent, young, old, black and white, rich and poor, but not the queers, and of course not the atheists. I just added that last part. As stated in his inaugural address, Governor Bentley believes his job is to make everyone's lives better. Really, I just didn't quite get that. Ashfaq Taufik, president of the Birmingham Islamic Society, told the newspaper he wasn't sure how Bentley's remarks were intended. You're not? Oh, please, please, Mr. Taufik. Taufik. Mr. Taufik said... No, Taufik. That's right, Taufik. Mr. Taufik said, quote, does it mean that those who, according to him, are not saved are less important than those who are saved? Does he want those of us who do not belong to the Christian faith to adopt his faith? The official with the Anti-Defamation League, Bill Nigut, said it sounded like Bentley was using the office of governor to advocate for Christian conversion. You think? Watching lazy ass hippies like me, tree hugging, love making, pro-choice and gay wedding, widespread digging hippies like me, skin color blinded, conspiracy minded, protesters of corporate greed. We who have nothing and most likely will till we all end up locked up in jail by conservative.
Be afraid. Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
William Hartung is a journalist, a writer. He's the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. And, excuse me, he's also the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, published this month by Nation Books. And writing at Tom Dispatch, a couple of days ago, he has a piece, is Lockheed Martin shadowing you? Do you know what Lockheed Martin is? It's a giant weapons corporation. And what Hartung points out is if you have been paying attention, you're aware that Lockheed Martin is in your life. Or as Hartung puts it, if you have a life, Lockheed Martin is likely part of it. He says that Lockheed Martin, the weapons manufacturer, doesn't actually run the U.S. government, but sometimes it seems as if it might as well. It received $36 billion in government contracts in 2008 alone, more than any company in history. And it now does work for more than two dozen government agencies, from the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy to the Department of Agriculture and the Environmental Protection Agency. It's involved in surveillance and information processing for the CIA, the FBI, the Internal Revenue Service, the National Security Agency, the Pentagon, the Census Bureau, and the U.S. Postal Service. I'm talking about Lockheed Martin. And Lockheed Martin has even helped train those friendly TSA agents who pat you down at the airport. Now, also the company produces cluster bombs. Those are the bombs that jump up in the air and spin around and explode and rip children and people and civilians to pieces. They do cluster bombs. They design nuclear weapons. They make the F-35 Lightning, which is an overpriced, behind-schedule, underperforming combat aircraft that is slated to be bought by customers in more than a dozen countries. Uh-huh. And when it comes to weaponry, that's just the start of a long list. In recent years, though, Lockheed Martin has moved beyond anything usually associated with weapons corporation and has been virtually running its own foreign policy, doing everything from hiring interrogators for U.S. overseas prisons like Guantanamo Bay in Cuba and Abu Ghraib in Iraq. This is Lockheed Martin. To managing a private intelligence network in Pakistan and helping write the Afghan Constitution. Do you understand this? Hartung goes on. Consider Lockheed Martin's sheer size for a moment. The company receives one of every $14 spent by the Pentagon. One of every $14 spent by the Pentagon goes to Lockheed Martin. Oh, and by the way, of course, it spent $12 million on congressional lobbying and campaign contributions in 2009 alone. Not surprisingly, Lockheed Martin is a top contributor to the incoming House Armed Services Committee Chairman, Republican Howard P. Buck McCone of California. Buck, giving him more than $50,000 in the most recent election cycle. It also tops the list, Lockheed Martin does, of donors to Senator Daniel Inouye, Democrat of Hawaii, the powerful chair of the House, or the Senate Appropriations Committee, and he describes himself, anyway, does, as the number one earmarks guy in the U.S. Congress. That's me. While the bulk of all this influence peddling may be perfectly legal, the company also has quite a track record when it comes to lawbreaking. Lockheed Martin ranks number one. On the lawbreaker database maintained by the Project on Government Oversight, which is a Washington, D.C.-based watchdog group. That'll soon disappear, I'm sure. How in the world, William Hartung asks, how in the world did Lockheed Martin become more than just a military contractor? Well, quick history. Its first significant foray outside the world of weaponry came in the early 1990s when plain old Lockheed, it had not yet merged with Martin Marietta, bought Datacom, a company specializing in providing services for state and city governments, and turned it into the foundation for a new business unit called Lockheed Information Management Services, IMS. In turn, IMS managed to win contracts in 44 states. How do you suppose they did that? And several foreign countries for tasks ranging from collecting parking fines and tolls to tracking down deadbeat dads and running welfare-to-work job training programs. The result was a number of high-profile failures. But, hey, you can't do everything right, right? You can, you know. Lockheed Martin. So after a series of failures, it turned to the federal government, where it promptly racked up deals with the IRS, the Census Bureau, the U.S. Postal Service, among other agencies. As a result, Lockheed Martin is now involved in nearly every interaction you have with the government. Paying your taxes? Lockheed Martin's all over it. The company is even creating a system that provides comprehensive data on every contact taxpayers have with the IRS, from phone calls to face-to-face meetings. You want to stand up, be counted by the U.S. Census? Lockheed Martin will take care of it. The company runs three centers in Baltimore, Phoenix, and Jeffersonville, Indiana. The process is up to 18 tractor trailers full of mail per day at the height of the 2010 census count. By the way, it's also developing something called the decennial, as in every 10 years, decennial response information service, which will collect and analyze information gathered from any source, from phone calls or the internet, any source. You fill out a little form and send in to win a cell phone. According to Preston Wade, Associate Director of the Census, this new service, the Decennial Response Information Service, will be a, quote, big catch net, catching all the data that comes in no matter where it comes from, end quote. You want to get a package across the country? Lockheed Martin cameras will scan barcodes and recognize addresses so your package can be sorted without human intervention. You want to commit a crime? Uh-oh. Lockheed Martin is in charge of the FBI's Integrated Automatic Fingerprint Identification System, a database of 55 million sets of fingerprints. The company also produces biometric identification devices that will know who you are by scanning your iris, recognizing your face, or coming up with novel ways of collecting your fingerprints in DNA. As Lockheed Martin likes to say, it's in the business of making everyone's lives an open book, which, of course, is a great benefit to all of us, right? The company says, thanks to biometric technology, people don't have to worry about forgetting a password or bringing multiple forms of identification. Things just got a little easier. They actually say that. Now, if it seems a little creepy to you that the same company making ballistic missiles is also processing your taxes, accessing your fingerprints, scanning your packages, ensuring that it's easier than ever to collect your DNA and counting you for the census, just calm down. Rest assured, Lockheed Martin's interest in getting inside your private life via intelligence collection and surveillance has remained remarkably undiminished in the 21st century. Just calm down. It's okay. Tim Shorrock, author of the seminal book Spies for Hire, has described Lockheed Martin as, quote, the largest defense contractor and private intelligence force in the world, end quote. As far back as 2002, remember the Total Information Awareness Program that was formed? Former National Security Advisor and convicted felon Admiral John Poindexter, remember his pet project, TIA, Total Information Awareness, giant database to collect telephone numbers, credit cards, all kinds of personal information about U.S. citizens in the name of fighting terrorism. Remember, the program was defunded by Congress the following year, but concerns remain that the National Security Agency is now running the program anyway. Guess who's taken care of everything there. Yeah. In the meantime, since at least 2004, Lockheed Martin has been involved in the Pentagon's counterintelligence field activity, which collects personal data on American citizens for storage in a database known as Threat and Local Observation Notice. It goes by the acronym TALON. Now, Congress shut down the domestic spying aspect of the program in 2007. The Pentagon's counterintelligence field activity itself continues to operate. In 2005, Washington Post military intelligence expert William Arkin revealed that while the database was theoretically being used to track anyone suspected of terrorism, drug trafficking, or espionage, he wrote, quote, some military gumshoe or overzealous commander just has to decide someone is a threat to the military for the whole thing to be brought into play. Among the threatening citizens actually tracked by this program were members of anti-war groups. Now, as part of its role in this counterintelligence field activity, Lockheed Martin was not only monitoring intelligence, but also, quote, estimating future threats. What? Estimating future threats. Well, that sounds like fun. Estimating, that's like the movie, the Tom Cruise movie. Minority Report? Estimate future? There's a little bit more here. Stick around. This is such fun. Lockheed Martin. It's in your life, sweetheart. The octopus, or as Matt Taibbi referred in a different context, this huge vampire squid. This time it's called Lockheed Martin. It's in your life, Truth Seeker, whether you want it there or not, whether you're aware of it or not. Lockheed Martin is also intimately bound up in the workings of the National Security Agency, America's largest spy outfit. In addition to producing spy satellites for the NSA, the company is in charge of Project Groundbreaker, a $5 billion 10-year effort to upgrade the NSA's internal telephone and computer networks. Now, while Lockheed Martin is probably watching you at home, it has also been involved in questionable activities abroad that go well beyond supplying weapons to regions in conflict. I don't have to name them, right? Of course, there were those interrogators it recruited for America's offshore prison system from Guantanamo to Afghanistan. And the charges of torture and abuse, of course, that so naturally went with them. But the real scandal the company has been embroiled in involves overseeing an assassination program in Pakistan. Ah, Lockheed Martin, we kill! We kill for profit! Ah! Initially, it was billed as an information-gathering operation using private companies to generate data the CIA and other U.S. intelligence agencies allegedly could not get on their own. But instead, the deal turned out to be supplying targeting information used by U.S. Army Special Forces troops to locate and kill people. The private firms involved were managed by Lockheed Martin under a $22 million contract from the U.S. Army. And as Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times has reported, there were just two small problems with the effort. Quote, the American military is largely prohibited from operating in Pakistan. And under Pentagon rules, the Army's not allowed to hire contractors for spying, end quote. So, much as in the Iran-Contra scandal of the late 1980s, when Sean Hannity's buddy, Oliver North, set up a network of shell companies to evade the laws against arming right-wing paramilitaries in Nicaragua, the Army just simply used Lockheed Martin to do an end run around the rules limiting U.S. military and intelligence activities in Pakistan. Oh, and it shouldn't come as a surprise that one of the people involved in the Lockheed Martin managed network was Dwayne Claridge, ex-CIA man who once had been knee-deep in the Iran-Contra affair. These are tight circles, Truth Seeker. Now, consider all this, but a Lockheed Martin crisis, a full accounting of this shadow government here in the United States would fill volumes. After all, it is the number one contractor not only for the Pentagon, but also for the Department of Energy. It ranks number two for the Department of State, number three for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, number four for the Department of Justice and Housing and Urban Development. A weapons manufacturer. Are you listening? Even listing the government and quasi-governmental agencies the company has contacts with is a daunting task. But here's just a partial rundown. The Department of Agriculture, the Bureau of Land Management, the Census Bureau, the Coast Guard, the Department of Defense, including the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, the Missile Defense Agency, the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Federal Aviation Administration, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Federal Technology Department, the Food and Drug Administration, the General Services Administration, the Geological Society, the Department of Homeland Security, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Internal Revenue Service, the National Institutes of Health, the Department of State, the Social Security Administration, the U.S. Customs Service, the U.S. Postal Service, the Department of Transportation, the Transportation Security Agency, the Department of Veterans Affairs. Lockheed Martin. Death, destruction, weaponry, murder, mayhem, assassinations, and all of those agencies I just mentioned to you. And as Hartung concludes in this article, when President Eisenhower warned 50 years ago this month of the dangers of, quote, unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex, end quote, he could never have dreamed that one for-profit weapons outfit would be so fully, or would so fully insinuate itself into so many aspects of American life. Lockheed Martin has helped turn Eisenhower's dismal mid-20th century vision into a for-profit military-industrial surveillance complex fit for the 21st century, one in which no government activity is now beyond its reach. I feel safer already. William Hartung is the director of the Arms and Security Initiative, the New America Foundation, and he is the author of a new book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. It's published by Nation Books this month. But as the psychopath Glenn Beck will tell you, the communists are here! The communists are here! And we have to shoot them in the head! The communists are in the government! The communists are here and the communists are there! And the radical progressives are destroying the country! Pay attention to what I'm saying! You gotta shoot them in the head! Look over here! Don't look over there and see what the national security state is really doing, because I'm Glenn Beck. I'm a whore. I'm a cheap $25 whore. It's my job to entertain you while the military-industrial complex does you. I'll see you tomorrow. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.